Hello and welcome to the Sobremesa podcast. I hope your year is getting off to a good start. And I just wanted to start the episode by saying a huge thank you to all of those that have donated towards our podcast. We are currently having a bit of a fundraising drive because we've come up against some production costs. So if you'd like to donate, then you can find the link to our Buy Us a Coffee Fund in the description of this episode. And also, if you want to help the podcast grow in 2024, which, you know, we are hoping to do quite a bit, then remember you can follow us on Twitter and share our episodes with people that you think might be interested and get them to subscribe on their preferred podcast platform. And if the platform allows you, give us a review. You can also give us feedback or pitch episode ideas to us via our email, which is the.sobremesa.podcast@gmail.com. We always love to hear from listeners. So without further ado, here is this week's episode. So with me today, I have Eric Calderwood, Associate Professor of Comparative Literature at the University of Illinois, and the author of the book, On Earth or in Poems, The Many Lives of Al-Andalus. So welcome to the Sobremesa podcast, Eric.
Thanks so much for having me, Alan. I'm happy to be here.
So, Eric, I mean, Al-Andalus is kind of, well, can you give us a bit of a lowdown on what Al-Andalus is?
Sure, absolutely. And yeah, that's great because it's the key term of the book. And so we should start there. Well, first and foremost, Al-Andalus refers to a specific place and time in Iberian history. Al-Andalus is the Arabic name used to describe the parts of the Iberian Peninsula, so today's Spain and Portugal, that were ruled by Muslims in the Middle Ages from 711 until 1492. And so for a shorthand, we could say medieval Muslim Iberia, or the parts of the Iberian Peninsula under Muslim rule from 711 to 1492.
So I've read your book. It's really great. Thanks for letting me read it. I really enjoyed it.
Thanks for reading it.
It's not your average history book. You know, it's not going from, you know, the 700s to the 1400s when it's not like a linear history book. You treat history in a very different way, which I think it makes for really interesting reading and makes it like very current and makes you like kind of feel what Al-Andalus is. So can you talk a bit about why you treat history in this way? And can you kind of explain to the listeners what you mean by different versions of Al-Andalus?
Sure, thanks. Well, first of all, I should just say right off the top that this book is not actually a history of Al-Andalus. And so if readers pick it up, I mean, I do think that you can find a lot of information about Al-Andalus there, but ultimately it's not about what Al-Andalus was in the past, but rather what Al-Andalus does today, meaning what does the memory of Al-Andalus do to promote a number of different cultural and political projects? And so the book, instead of being a straight up narrative history of Al-Andalus, explores a bunch of different narratives about Al-Andalus and tries to understand how those narratives have been deployed or mobilized by different cultural and political projects today, or I should say really from the 19th century up into the present. And so another way that I like to describe the book is I like to describe it as a history of the present through the prism of Al-Andalus, like using Al-Andalus to understand some of the diverse cultural and political movements of today's world.
Yeah, one thing that's interested me was the word utopia crops up a lot in the book. And, you know, the first chapter the first and second chapters are about two different versions of Al-Andalus. You have Arab Al-Andalus, right? Why Arab Al-Andalus and not just Al-Andalus? Like, why these different versions?
Yeah.
You explain a bit about, you know, the Arab one and the other one? I think the second one that you go into a lot is the Berber Al-Andalus.
Absolutely. And, you know, I realize I didn't entirely respond to your first question about my approach to history. And so we can circle back to that in a moment if you like. But maybe I'll just start off by saying how the book is organized.
Yeah.
I decided not actually to take a kind of straight chronological order where page one starts, say, at 711 and we move slowly up until the present. And the reason for this really has to do with the object of study, with Al-Andalus itself. Part of the kind of very basic way of describing what I'm saying in this book is there are a lot of Al-Andaluses out there.
Yeah.
There are a lot of different ways of talking about Al-Andalus. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of people around the world who talk about Al-Andalus, even if they might mean something different when they evoke it. And so part of what the book is trying to do is figure out, like, what are some of the main ways of talking about Al-Andalus that circulate in the world today? Where and why have they emerged? And who has found meaning or political or social utility in them? And so instead of having one kind of uniform story of Al-Andalus that unfolds chronologically, it's more like the multiverse of Al-Andalus, in which there are several different Al-Andaluses that are unfolding simultaneously, sometimes in conversation with each other and sometimes not. And so a lot of the book is trying to figure out which Al-Andalus are people talking about when they claim or they imagine or evoke Al-Andalus, and why does that way of Al-Andalus matter to them? So you've brought up two of the many stories of Al-Andalus that I discuss in the book. In chapters 1 and 2, I try to show how Al-Andalus and debates about Al-Andalus have intersected with debates about race and ethnicity in North Africa and the Middle East from the 19th century into the present. And in large part in those chapters, I'm trying to show how ideas about Al-Andalus or stories about Al-Andalus have served to shore up definitions of two major ethnic or cultural groups, Arabs and Berbers. I'll start with the first one, and then maybe you can come back to it. I'll try to give short explanations of what I mean by that, and then maybe you can come back.
It was interesting that you refer to it as Arab and not Muslim, right? I mean, that was the thing that struck me most about that idea.
Yeah, and so, I mean, I think in chapter one, I'm trying to identify what I think of as perhaps the dominant way of talking about Al-Andalus in Europe, the United States, and the Middle East, one of the dominant ways, which is a way of talking about Al-Andalus that centers Arabs and Arabness. This is a mode of talking about Al-Andalus that is centered on ethnicity, or sometimes ethnicity and language, so the Arabic language, and in some ways is sidelining the question of religion, Islam. And this is a way of talking about Al-Andalus that really connects it to the Arab heartlands in the East, particularly to Syria, which is the place where the Umayyad dynasty emerged, and the Umayyads were one of the first rulers of Al-Andalus. And it's a way of kind of understanding Al-Andalus as a bridge between Greco-Roman, the classical heritage of Greece, of ancient Greece and Rome, and the European Renaissance. So this is the version of Al-Andalus that is a bridge between East and West, so between Syria and Europe, and a bridge between the ancient and the modern. And historically, I mean, this is a version of talking about Al-Andalus that is really centered on the period of Arab Umayyad rule, which is roughly the first 300 years of Andalusi history, so roughly 711 to the early 11th century. And it's a version of Andalusi history that's really celebrated Arab contributions while sidelining, sometimes ignoring, or sometimes even outright demonizing the contributions of other ethnic and cultural groups in Al-Andalus, and namely the contributions of North Africans, or the indigenous people of North Africans, who are known as Berbers, or sometimes Imazighen. And so in chapter one, I'm trying to show a history of what I could say is maybe Arabizing Al-Andalus, thinking of Al-Andalus as predominantly an Arab phenomenon, who gets included and who gets left out. And then in chapter two, I'm trying to show a number of more recent responses to that narrative from North Africa, in which a number of different scholars, writers, and artists in North Africa push back and want to assert the North Africanness of Al-Andalus, or the essential North African contributions of Al-Andalus.
I mean, going back to the Arabness of Al-Andalus, I mean, could you expand a bit on your critique of, which I thought was, I didn't know this existed until I read your book, but you know, the Ramadan soap opera.
The Ramadan soap operas, or musalsalat, so just kind of TV series, Ramadan TV series, are one of the major case studies of that chapter on the Arab Al-Andalus. I should say that for those of you who don't know anything about Ramadan TV, Ramadan is one of the, it's kind of like what I'd call the sweep season in Arabic language television. It's a time of year in which Arabic language television producers release their biggest productions, many of which very often have 30 chapters, so one for each night of the month of Ramadan. And so you have these 30-episode TV series that are released and coincide with Ramadan, and that people follow them. And the biggest ones are often aired just after iftar, so just after the breaking of the fast, when everyone's kind of sitting down, relaxed on the couch to enjoy together. And so while this phenomenon of Ramadan TV is immense, and there's a whole body of scholarship on it, what I'm really interested in here is the fact that a lot of major Ramadan TV series in the past 20 years have been set in Al-Andalus. I would say like Al-Andalus is one of the most popular themes of historical dramas in Ramadan television. And so what I'm trying to do in that part of the book is describe this phenomenon of Al-Andalus TV series, what they're about, and what the stories of Al-Andalus, what kinds of stories about Al-Andalus they tend to promote. And so I should say that the most famous, most of these Ramadan TV series about Al-Andalus, certainly the most famous ones, have been made by Syrian television creators. So Syria is one of the major hubs of Arabic language television production. And something that is really notable about them is that these are TV series that really tap into this idea of Al-Andalus as a pan-Arab phenomenon. Very often, they are TV series that emphasize the connections, the historical connections between Umayyad Syria. So the Umayyads were one of the first Muslim dynasties, and they were also the first dynasty to rule in Al-Andalus. So you can say that they're ones in which a lot of, like, very often they have characters that might start in Syria and end up in Al-Andalus, or people are moving back and forth between the Middle East and Al-Andalus. And these are TV series that are very much meant to celebrate Al-Andalus as an important chapter in Arab cultural history, and to promote a sense of cultural identification, not only because of thinking of Al-Andalus as a phenomenon that was rooted or originated in Syria, but also because these are Arabic language television series that are watched all around the Arabic speaking world. And so if you're in the Gulf or in Morocco, or even in the Arab diaspora in the Americas, you see these TV series and identify with Al-Andalus as a kind of, as a chapter of Arab cultural identity. I say Arab cultural identity because, for two reasons. One, because with very, very few exceptions, these are television series that almost exclusively focus on the period between 711 and the 11th century. Right. So that is the period in which Al-Andalus was under Arab Umayyad rule, in which the rulers of Al-Andalus were Arabs.
Yeah.
But as we already said at the top of the episode, Al-Andalus, its history stretches until 1492.
Yeah.
So why do all these Arabic language TV series tend to end in the 11th century? Because that's precisely the moment in which Al-Andalus, the Umayyad rule in Al-Andalus collapses. So the kind of first major Arab dynasty collapses. And what emerges in its absence or in its wake is these two North African dynasties. First, the Almoravids, then the Almohads, who go on to rule Al-Andalus for the next two centuries. And so you could say basically that these TV series are basically saying Al-Andalus pretty much comes to an end at the moment in which Arabs stop being dominant in Al-Andalus. Right. It is precisely the moment in which North Africans come into power in Al-Andalus, and which Al-Andalus starts to function more in a north-south axis across the Strait of Gibraltar and less on an east-west axis, so Damascus, right, Al-Andalus. It's precisely that moment in which there's really nothing more to talk about. So it's almost like they almost are suggesting that the narrative of Al-Andalus starts with the arrival of Arabs to Al-Andalus in the 8th century, with the grandeur of Arab rule throughout the 9th and 10th century, and ends with the collapse of the Arab Umayyad rule and the rise of the North African dynasties. Now you can imagine, these Ramadan television series are just one of many different cultural products that narrate Andalusian history in this way.
Yeah.
In the book, I focus on a very popular trilogy by the now deceased Syrian director Hatem Ali that was broadcast in the first decade of the 21st century, but I try to situate that trilogy in a much broader corpus of texts that are basically presenting this same narrative of Al-Andalus, an Andalus that is rooted in Syria. Now, you can imagine that for many viewers, that vision of Al-Andalus leaves out a lot of people. You said at the top of this that like one of the issues with Al-Andalus is that it's kind of messy, right? Do I say Arab or Muslim? Do I say African? Do I say Spanish, Iberian?
Uh-huh.
It throws into question and conflates all these categories that we think of as kind of clean and neatly delineated, but they're actually not. And Al-Andalus throws those confusions into question. It makes us struggle to figure out what adjectives to use.
And so
some of the things I try to do in this book is show how each vision of Al-Andalus kind of picks which adjectives it's going to privilege, which adjectives it's going to emphasize, and which adjectives it's going to leave out, which groups it's going to leave out. Okay. And so in the case of these Ramadan television series, you can imagine, for example, there are a number of different possible responses to it. Imagine you're a North African observer, an Arabic-speaking North African or a spectator in Morocco or Algeria, because these Ramadan TV series are extremely popular, and they circulate throughout the Arabic-speaking world. You're basically seeing a TV series which is like, Al-Andalus was great until the North Africans came and ruled. That's when everything went to shit, by language. Yeah. And you can imagine that a North African might say, well, what about those next two centuries in which Al-Andalus and Morocco, today's Morocco, were united as one political territory, when Al-Andalus was ruled by North African dynasties based in North Africa, but there was a fluid movement of people and ideas across the Strait of Gibraltar. Isn't that an Al-Andalus worth thinking about as well? So you can see, I mean, the rhetorical question is meant to be a lead into really what the topic of the second book is, the second chapter. The second chapter of the book is basically a critique of the Arab Al-Andalus narrative. It's an attempt to study different efforts by North African writers and artists to push back against that narrative and present an Andalus that is anchored in North Africa and anchored in North African contributions.
Right. I think it was really interesting what you say about, you know, someone from North Africa watching a Ramadan series and then like, where's two centuries gone? I mean, I was thinking back to when I was younger. I grew up watching American and British war films with my dad because he's a war film fanatic, mainly based around World War II. And I always thought, you know, Britain and America won the war. And then it wasn't until I saw like an infograph online of how many Russians died in the Second World War. And I, thinking back, you know, the Russians were never mentioned in any of those films. So it really does have a massive impact on how you perceive things.
Indeed, yeah. And I think the connection there with that example you just gave is with these stories about Al-Andalus and the Ramadan TV series, it's not really a question of falsehood. I'm not saying that there weren't Arab rulers at Al-Andalus and they didn't accomplish great things. It's really a question of selection, politics of selection. Like, where do you focus the lens?
Uh-huh.
Do you focus the lens, to use your example, on all the Americans and British who fought in the World War and somehow leave out of the picture all these other groups who did? Something similar happens with Al-Andalus. Like each time someone tells a story about Al-Andalus, they decide to focus the lens on one person, one group, and certain assumptions come out of that choice. The choices you make about who to center tell you a lot about what you understand Al-Andalus to be and what its impact is on the world today.
And then, so who were the Berbers? You mentioned them earlier can you tell us a bit about who they are?
Sure, absolutely. So Berber is an umbrella term to describe the indigenous people of North Africa.
Uh-huh.
So the people who were living in Northwest Africa. So if you can think of the area stretching roughly from today's Libya down to Mauritania, before the arrival of Arab Muslim conquerors in the 7th century.
Right.
So before the rapid expansion of Islam and with it, the expansion of the Arabic language into North Africa in the 7th century, the people, the dominant group of North Africa, we now call them Berbers. I say we now call them because that is not a term that was in use before the 7th century. That's not a term that the people now known as Berbers used to describe themselves. It's a term that Arabs use to describe them. And in fact, it's one that has some derogatory connotations. It's etymologically linked to the idea of barbarians, this idea that Berbers speak a sort of unintelligible babble as opposed to the eloquence of the Arabic language. So Berbers is an umbrella term for thinking about one of the major groups of North Africa, though many specialists today prefer to use a different term, Amazigh. Which is free from some of those derogatory connotations and is a name that people in that group use to describe themselves. Though there is a little bit of debate around these two terms, and I get in really into the weeds of that terminological debate in the books, I think just for the sake of simplicity here, I'm just going to oscillate between Berber, which is the more common term in English, and Amazigh as two umbrella terms, albeit problematic ones, for talking about indigenous North Africans.
So, I mean, you said they ruled for the last two centuries and they were kind of fighting back against this, you know, all Arab Al-Andalus. Can you expand on that a bit more for us?
Yeah. I mean, so first of all, I should say that, you know, as we've already been touching on, Al-Andalus was this extremely diverse place. Often when we think about diversity in Al-Andalus, particularly in the Spanish context, we talk about religious diversity, right?
This idea of
convivencia, Muslims, Christians, and Jews. But we can also think about other kinds of diversity, linguistic diversity, cultural diversity, ethnic diversity. Two of the major ethnic groups of Al-Andalus were Arabs, the one we were talking about before, and Berbers. And in fact, for long periods, particularly at the beginning, the majority of the Muslim population in Al-Andalus was actually North African Berber, not Arab. And putting aside this question of demographics, North African Berbers or Amazigh people made major contributions to Andalusi society really from the beginning until the end. In fact, it was a North African commander, Tariq bin Ziyad, who led the conquest of Al-Andalus in 711. As you've already noted, two North African dynasties that were both ruled by Berbers, the Almoravids and the Almohads, ruled Al-Andalus from the 11th to the 13th century. In the last period of Andalusi history, which is when Al-Andalus was reduced to the Kingdom of Granada, the Kingdom of Granada had these really intense political and cultural connections with North Africa in that period. And after the fall of 1492, a lot of Andalusis left and found refuge in North Africa. And so there's this really long and rich history of connections between North Africa and Al-Andalus, and particularly between North Africa and Amazigh or Berber people in Al-Andalus. The reason I bring this up is, as I was already saying when we were talking about Ramadan television, if you read some of the most popular accounts of Andalusi history, be they in Arabic, in Spanish, or in English, mysteriously, these people will kind of fall out of the picture. Or if they're in the picture, they'll often be treated as enemies, as right. sort of antagonistic to the tolerant refinement of the Arab Umayyads. The most popular book in English about Al-Andalus is probably Maria Rosa Mena Calls The Ornament of the World. It's a beautiful book to which I owe so much. But I have to say, I really disagree and I'm deeply uncomfortable with how she treats North Africans. She calls them fanatics. She calls them backward. She uses words to demonize them, to treat them as others who are somehow outside of Andalusi culture, while very much treating Andalusi culture as a synonym for Arab culture.
Right.
And so in that second chapter, the Berber Al-Andalus, what I'm trying to do there is rescue a sort of counter history of Al-Andalus,
yeah.
one in which Berbers are no longer at the margins, but rather at the center of the story. And in order to do that, I tried to trace the development over the past 100 years or so of North African writings, and then more recently, filmmaking, other forms of art that have tried to revisit the history of Al-Andalus and center the role that North African Berbers have played in it. And so there are a number of examples I discussed in the book. I'll just mention one of them now that might be of interest to your listeners. Back in 2019 and 2020, just before the COVID pandemic sent us all home, the Alhambra in Granada opened this massive exhibit called Zirid Granada and the Berber Universe. Now, the Zirids were actually the founders of the city of Granada. They were one of these Berber dynasties or groups that emerged in the 11th century during the collapse of Umayyad rule. And basically, the whole thesis of that exhibit was, Granada, and by extension, pretty much all of Al-Andalus after the 11th century, is deeply indebted to Berbers and is kind of part of the Berber universe, to use the words of that exhibition. And so that and that exhibit, you know, I just mentioned it as one example of many that was particularly prominent. I'm mentioning it because it was at a kind of Spanish institution that might be familiar to many of your listeners, the Alhambra, and it got a lot of media attention. Yeah. I would say that it's one example of many of these kind of ongoing attempts to recenter North Africans, and not only North Africans, but specifically North African Berbers or Imazighen in the story of Al-Andalus.
I mean, yeah, you can't really mention Al-Andalus without mentioning the Alhambra, right? I mean, it's kind of, they go together when you mention them. The way that you sort of analyze in Al-Andalus is very much through a, what we've been talking about so far, I mean, sorry, has been very positive, you know, talking about how different cultures are using Al-Andalus as a positive thing, you know, as part of their dynasty, and you know, they're trying to fight over this dynasty that they both want to have some sort of claim to. But also, you mention in the book, and I'm sure many listeners will be aware of, you know, the most recently in the last 20 to 30 years, the demonization of Muslim people, and you know, Al-Andalus as is weaponized by some terrorist groups as well, like Al-Qaeda, I believe, used it when they bombed the Madrid trains. So, I mean, it's really interesting that you do take this take on it. What are your thoughts around the sort of more negative? I mean, you mentioned in the book about 9/11. I mean, that's the way you open your book, and I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah, it's a tough question, right? And I think you're really putting your finger on one of the most uncomfortable things of talking about Al-Andalus. I think I'm going to push back against the question, but maybe hopefully in a way that's playful and helpful.
Yeah, yeah.
And you can then push back against me. Like, I guess I would push back against the description of either the Arab Al-Andalus or the Berber Al-Andalus as positive.
Right.
I would say that they're group affirming.
Right, okay.
But usually in order to affirm one communal identity, you have to draw the lines around it, and you have to say some people are in it and some people are out of it.
Uh-huh.
And I would say that this process of the us versus them is built into a lot of thinking about Al-Andalus. It just, the us and the them change depending on what the project is.
Yeah.
Really, like, my main point here is that I think that there's a tendency to want to find a kind of positive utopian story in Al-Andalus.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that we're doing a disservice to Al-Andalus by not dealing with its messiness.
Yeah.
Its messiness by saying that, like, Al-Andalus is associated with monuments like the Alhambra or ideas like Convivencia that we might feel really proud of. But yeah, it's also associated with ideological projects and moments that we might not feel proud of. For example, the memory of Al-Andalus was one of the main things that the Franco regime used to justify Spanish colonialism in Morocco. The idea was, we're not colonizing, we're just returning Morocco to Spain because we're both part of the legacy of Al-Andalus. Right. So, you know, that's an example of which Al-Andalus is a sort of tool of colonial domination.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's just one of many ways in which Al-Andalus can serve all kinds of projects. And in fact, it always is serving all kinds of projects at the same time. And it's not just that we can easily divide them into, like, the good projects and the bad projects.
Yeah.
Even the ones that we might think of as good often have uncomfortable side stories. Like this story of celebrating Arabs, there's nothing wrong with celebrating the role that the Umayyad dynasty played in establishing a beautiful city in their capital city of Cordoba. The problem comes when you use that to build an identity project that is exclusively predicated on either excluding or sometimes outright demonizing other groups like North Africans. And so I would say that in many cases, there's always this kind of give and take, right?
Yeah.
It gives us the tools to affirm certain kind of ideas and narratives, but at the same time, those tools often are only possible if they exclude some people or if they demonize some people.
Yeah.
So let's talk about, like, one of the things that you were bringing up about demonization of Muslims.
I like the way the book takes a turn politically to feminist and Palestinian versions of Al-Andalus, because it's something I didn't really know what to expect when opening these chapters. Yeah, I mean, you mentioned, you know, the demonization of Muslims, and you know, the Bush administration and the Blair administration in the UK, you know, using the demonization of Muslims, like, we're going to save women from the men, we're going to save women from the veil, we're going to save women from Islam itself. Playing with that was really interesting. I just thought it was fascinating how you mentioned how feminists are using Al-Andalus these days.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, thanks for that comment. I'm glad that you brought that up. I think something I'm trying to do here is tap into the radical possibilities of the radical politics that might be inherent in certain ways of talking about Al-Andalus. Mm-hmm. There are a number of different projects that I trace and follow in the book, and one of them is this idea of what I call a feminist Al-Andalus, or people who have used Al-Andalus as a source of inspiration and have imagined Al-Andalus as a place of exceptional creativity and accomplishment, or even freedom, for Muslim and Arab women. And this is, like, when I started working on this book, this is something that I was very aware of. Like, I was very familiar with a lot of recent, like, 21st century texts that were centered on powerful Andalusi female figures, be they real historical figures or fictional ones. And I wanted to know, like, what's the history of this idea? Like, when did people start centering the lives of Andalusi women and using them to tell a larger story about how Al-Andalus fits into the narrative of feminism? So I should say, and I think that this will then help me, like, circle back to your prompt and your question, that, like, one of the reasons that Al-Andalus has proven such a productive site for feminists, particularly in Muslim and Arab majority contexts, is that it's one way of neutralizing or sidestepping one of the problems that is associated with feminism as a political program in North Africa, the Middle East, and a lot of the colonized world. As you were suggesting, the idea that the West, be it Europe or the United States, has a kind of both a moral obligation and a right or a mission to save Muslim women was actually, and continues to be, one of the primary justifications for imperialist and colonial projects in the Muslim and Arab worlds. Whether we're looking at 19th century British colonial bureaucrats or, like, the talking heads of the Bush administration, there's a pretty clear through line that goes from 19th century colonial discourses to the Bush era justification of the war in Afghanistan that basically says, yes, we should fund these massive imperial military expeditions in the Middle East, North Africa, or more further into the Muslim world, such as Afghanistan, because of the plight of the oppressed Muslim woman. I'm putting that in vigorous air quotes. And so, like, right off the bat, the project of feminism comes with some challenges in these contexts, because it is directly associated in some ways with the memory of colonialism, and in some ways was used as a tool of colonialism, that a certain form of European or Western feminist ideology was used as a tool to justify colonial projects. Now, one way to get out of that system or out of that bind is to imagine other feminist histories, to imagine a history of feminism that's not purely rooted through the histories of feminism in Europe, the West, and the United States. And that's where Al-Andalus comes in. Starting in the 19th century and really continuing up into the 21st century, you see a lot of female artists, writers, scholars, thinkers, both Muslim and Arab, who turn to Al-Andalus and celebrate the women of Al-Andalus in a way to root their advocacy for feminism and women's rights in a history that does not rely on Western feminism, but instead is deeply rooted in a indigenous or kind of autochthonous tradition of Muslim or Arab culture. In some way, the claim is you don't need to export feminism to the Muslim Arab world because it has always been stitched into the fabric of the Muslim Arab world. We need only look at the example of the women of Al-Andalus and the incredible accomplishments they had. And so the feminist Al-Andalus, that chapter, is about the history of how the memory of Al-Andalus has been really generative for thinking about and establishing a kind of indigenous tradition of feminist thought in the Middle East and North Africa starting in the late 19th century, which is where that chapter starts, and going all the way up into the 21st century.
And you mentioned in the chapter a person called Walala. Could you explain a bit about who she was?
Absolutely. In fact, when I gave an early version of that chapter to a dear friend of mine, he sent it back with a comment that I should call that chapter the Where's Walala chapter. Because indeed, it is a chapter that, among other things, is trying to trace the really diverse career of this one figure in contemporary culture. So first, let me say who Walala is, and second, I'll say a little bit about why she's important today. Walala bint al-Mustakfi was a significant poet and cultural figure of the late, of the early 11th century in Al-Andalus. She was born, I think, in 994 to the royal family, to the Umayyad family, which were the rulers of Al-Andalus at the time. And so she grew up in a sort of royal aristocratic setting. And she became famous for a number of things. One, because she was a very distinguished poet. Two, because she held a very famous literary salon in her home in Cordoba, where women and men would come together to debate pressing intellectual and literary issues of the day. Three, because she had a sort of torrid and highly public love affair with another poet, Ibn Zaydun, and they exchanged poems publicly back and forth, both when they were falling in love and when they were falling out of love. And so they had a kind of very public love affair that was played out through their poetry. And because Walala was known at the time, or at least is remembered today, and this is where I'm starting to transition to the second part, as someone who had a kind of rebellious and independent spirit, as indicated by her willingness to buck different kinds of gender conventions. And so there are many stories about Walala and her kind of independent and rebellious spirit. So let me now transition to why thinking about Walala, this early, late 10th century, early 11th century poet, is important for understanding Al-Andalus today. Well, Walala, since the 19th century, has become a sort of key figure in this process of what I'm calling the feminist Al-Andalus, a key figure in imagining a feminist genealogy that runs from Al-Andalus to the present. And starting in the 19th century, you get the phenomenon of writers in the Middle East, North Africa, and beyond. The first and perhaps most famous example would be Zeynep Fawaz, who was a kind of pioneer of the Egyptian feminist movement, who celebrated Walala and her exploits and imagined themselves as, in some ways, daughters of Walala, imagined themselves as somehow following in the footsteps of Walala. And basically what I do in that chapter, one of the things I do is I try to take Walala and a few other famous figures from Al-Andalus and show how they've been reappropriated and repurposed and re-celebrated in literature and art and political writing from the 19th century into the 21st century. And I think, can I just give like a very specific example?
Yeah, of course.
Like how this works, because this might seem very abstract otherwise. I imagine this might be new. So one of the opening anecdotes I have for that chapter is about a piece of protest art from, I believe, 2016 by the Saudi visual artist Ms. Safa, who's a Saudi dissident based in Melbourne, Australia. And it was a piece of protest art. It was a street art that she made in Melbourne, a large installation that was meant to protest Saudi Arabia's guardianship laws. So these are the laws that made it necessary for women to have the permission of a male guardian if they wanted to get a passport or apply for it or do a number, engage in a number of different facets of public life. The thing that I found interesting about this is that when I saw pictures of this protest art, one of the things that immediately jumped out to me as a scholar of Al-Andalus is that it features in big, bold graffiti a quote from Walala, from this poet from Al-Andalus.
Wow.
And so here you have this example of a Saudi dissident living in Melbourne in the 21st century, advocating for women's rights in Saudi Arabia in the 21st century, and doing it by channeling not only the spirit and memory, but specifically the words, by quoting the words in graffiti of this 11th century Andalusi poet. And so you have the figure or the memory of a Walala serving as a way of imagining a feminist politics that's rooted in a larger Muslim and Arab history, but is directed to something happening in the 21st century.
Yeah.
And so that's just one example of many that I try to give in the chapter, in which you see Andalusi figures emerging as kind of sites for understanding feminist debates today.
You know, the fact that they can put on this history to, and they don't have to, you know, they don't need to fall back on, and it's a very cynical example, but they don't need to fall back on the British suffragettes, which is kind of, you know, even living in Spain, you know, you see a lot of people and the feminist movement here in Spain is enormous, using the suffragettes iconography. And I mean, that is good. I mean, you know, Spain is part of Europe, so I suppose that kind of makes sense. But, you know, Saudi Arabian women in Australia using Al-Andalus feminism poetry is pretty cool, really.
Yeah. And I mean, I would say also, if you allow me just to like riff once more on that example, it's an example that the dynamics of it are something that I see replay a lot in the book, in which you have an actor who's located somewhere very far from the historical site of Al-Andalus. So a Saudi artist living in Australia, nowhere near the Iberian Peninsula, turning to the memory of Al-Andalus to debate something happened in the present, but once again, not necessarily in the present, not in 21st century Spain or even in nearby Morocco, somewhere else.
Yeah.
Like, so one of the things I'm really interested in this book is like, how is it that Al-Andalus has sort of broken loose from its historical referent as this place that was rooted in the Iberian Peninsula and come to serve as an idea or a series of ideas that are meaningful to people all over the world, not just in Spain or North Africa, but in the Middle East, in South Asia, in the Americas. So it's really that extreme plasticity and the ability of Al-Andalus to travel that really fascinates me in this book.
Mm. I mean, I, like you said, using it all over the world. I mean, I actually got quite choked up reading the Palestine chapter, where you talk about the use of Palestine, and I wasn't sure what I was going to get from the chapter. Like, I wasn't sure which way you're going to go with it. But this is a very, it's very deep. I mean, you know, the time I'm recording this, there's an ongoing genocide in Palestine. 16,000 people been murdered, 6,000 of them children, and possibly more hidden under rubble. So, you know, reading this the other night was kind of, I don't know, I can't put it into words, but it choked me up quite a lot, really, reading about Palestine and how they used Al-Andalus as part of their liberation campaign. So could you talk a bit about this? And could you also talk a bit about who I think that you take the title of your book from, Mohammed Darwish as well? Could you tell us a bit about him?
I'm glad to have the opportunity to talk about this part of the book. But as you can imagine, it's a really tough time to be talking about it as well. I mean, this part of the book has become timely in ways that I never could have imagined when I wrote it. I mean, the Palestinian struggle was and remains ongoing, and so I knew it'd be timely that way. But it's resonating in a very particular way because of the ongoing suffering in Gaza and the surrounding areas. And for that reason, in the past few months, as I've had more opportunities to talk publicly about the book, I've actually been focusing on the Palestinian chapter, because it feels like it's one way in which I can use something, you know, my training as an academic in a kind of humble and modest way to contribute to a public conversation about Palestine and Palestinians, not only for thinking about their history and their current conditions, but also for imagining some future, some viable future for Palestine and Palestinians. And I'll say why that is. I mean, let me to get to that point, let me start with this person you said, Darwish. He is probably the most important Palestinian writer of the 20th century. He was born in the 1940s and died in 2008. He was born 6 years before the creation of the State of Israel in 1948. And his life very much followed the trials and tribulations of Palestine and the Palestinian people. And the story of Palestine is really woven into the fabric of his poetry. He is also, in addition to being a really beautiful poet, a deep thinker about Al-Andalus. I'd say a deep thinker about history in general, but he is someone who throughout his career wrote several things, both essays and poems about Al-Andalus. And I knew about that body of work coming into this project, and I thought, I'm going to write something about Darwish and Al-Andalus. And I kind of thought that chapter would be the Darwish chapter. And it turned out to be something much more complicated, because as I started reading Darwish's poetry about Al Andalus, I just ran into some basic questions about it. Like, how do these poems fit into a longer tradition of Palestinian writing about Al Andalus? Did Darwish kind of invent this idea? Al Andalus and Palestine should be written about together? Or is that a much older idea? And if so, has its meaning changed over time? And so those are just like the basic questions I went into with this chapter. Like, what does it mean to think about Al-Andalus from Palestine? What is productive when you put Palestine and Al-Andalus together? What I discovered while doing the work for that chapter and was that there's just a really long tradition of thinking about Al-Andalus and Palestine together that goes back at least to the 1920s, so at least to the early years of the British Mandate in Palestine. In the 1920s and 1930s, you see this kind of massive eruption in the Palestinian press and in Palestinian print culture of allusions to Al-Andalus, allusions to Palestine as the second Al-Andalus, the sister of Al-Andalus, the specter of Al-Andalus. And in all of those allusions, Al-Andalus is functioning as a kind of a warning tale, right? A cautionary tale. Palestine could become lost just as Al-Andalus was once lost in 1492. So it's a kind of harbinger of potential loss. And so my question was, does the story stop there? Is that what Al-Andalus means in Palestine? It's a symbol of loss and occupation. And if so, you know, I could have told that story, but maybe it wouldn't have been quite as interesting to me. But it turned out long after 1948, Al-Andalus continued to be this really persistent presence in Palestinian culture, and its meanings became really multifarious and supple. You still have this idea of Palestinian writers using Al-Andalus as a metaphor for loss and occupation, but you also have celebrations of Al-Andalus and using Al-Andalus as a symbol of resistance and resilience. And you even have people like Darwish, and this is coming back to your initial question, who use Al-Andalus not only to reflect on the past of Palestine, but also to imagine its possible future. In a 1983 interview with the French newspaper Le Monde, Darwish called Palestine the Andalus of the possible. And I kind of used that quote as the guiding, as the sort of through line for that chapter, because I wanted to ask, like, what is it that Al-Andalus has made possible for Palestinian writers and readers? What kind of thinking about history has it made possible for people living through the 20th and into the 21st century as Palestinians? And something I've found is that thinking about Al-Andalus has also helped Palestinians to think in a really fluid and interesting way about Palestinian time. Because the possibility that Darwish is pointing to when he calls Palestine the Andalus of the possible is not the possibility that Palestine could become lost, but rather the possibility that it could return at some point in the future. I mean, in some ways, I think Darwish is sort of pointing to a sort of Andalusi futurism, an idea that the power of Al-Andalus might not reside in what it can tell us about the past, but the ways in which it can allow us to imagine the future. And I really like that kind of less nostalgic past-oriented, more future-oriented vision of Al-Andalus that was coming out of Darwish. One that is not naively optimistic, but is also, you know, not stuck in the past. One that is trying to use thinking seriously about history as a way of launching an understanding of the present and possibly building a project of the future. So that's the kind of trajectory I tried to trace in that chapter, the Palestinian Al-Andalus, from the 1920s, in which Al-Andalus is a kind of harbinger of loss, to the 21st century, in which Al-Andalus is almost a kind of speculative space in which Palestinians can straddle past, present, and future in these really creative ways. So that's what I'm trying to do in that particular chapter. And if you allow me, I'm sorry for a somewhat long answer.
No,
I get really excited when talking about this part of the book, just because I felt like I learned so much by reading Palestinian writings about Al-Andalus, and particularly reading Darwish. And as you mentioned, the title of the book comes from Darwish, On Earth or in Poems. It comes from a poem that Darwish wrote in the 1990s about Al-Andalus, one of his most famous poems, at the end of which he writes, "And in the end, we will ask ourselves, was Al-Andalus here or there on earth or in poems. And I really loved this quote because I think it points to one of the key tensions in my book, which is this idea that Al-Andalus is both a place in history, so on earth, but also a place in the imagination, on poems. It's both, you know, this concrete place on the map that we can point to and say it went from 711 to 1492. And it's also an idea that has kind of sprung free from that historical definition and proven really generative for writers and artists all around the world. And that tension between history and poetry is at the center of the book. And I wanted to use, you know, I wanted to use that Darwishian title because ultimately I think Darwish is not only an object of study, he's not someone, just someone I'm analyzing, but he's also one of the main theoretical inspirations for the book. He's someone who taught me to think about Andalusi history in a new way.
I mean, when you talk about, you know, the Andalus of the future with regards to the Palestine context, you know, what do you mean?
Yeah, well, the phrase that Darwish uses is actually the Andalus of the possible.
Right, okay.
Not the Andalus of the future. But I do think it's something future-oriented. I think he's saying as opposed to the Andalus of a kind of lost paradise.
Yeah.
Something that is always focused on what was lost in the past rather than something that is imagining the possibilities of the future. So I do think fundamentally the conceptual question here is thinking about Al-Andalus a way of lamenting and perhaps even stagnating in the past, or is it actually a platform that allows us to interrogate the present and encourage us to imagine different kinds of futures? And I really think that when Darwish lands on this formulation of the Andalus of the possible, he's trying to call him, he's basically saying, yes, let's keep talking about Al-Andalus, but not so that we can shed tears over the past, but rather so that we can think about how that past might help us build something different in the future. So I think it's not just about the tense in which we talk about Al-Andalus, but it's also... Yeah. The ways in which we can look to the past to look also paradoxically to the future. So it has something to do with this very weird conceptual place that Al-Andalus occupies that is constantly straddling past, present, and future.
Yeah, which kind of like, which is probably why I kept saying the word utopia or like, you know, come up. Utopia in Greek meaning the place that doesn't exist, sort of thing, right? The place is there, right?
Yeah. That which is not but might be.
Yeah,
you know, I think Darwish would prefer the term poetry, but I think he means the same thing. By poetry, he means as opposed to history. If history is fixed, it's what was. Poetry is what might have been, what could be, what we can make possible, but only in the realm of the imagination. But I think that's a different way of saying about what you mean by utopia.
Yeah, like you said earlier, you know, the tension between poems and history in your book. No, definitely. Al-Andalus is used famously in the Trian Theater in Palestine, as we've just been talking about. But it's also used in Israel by two different groups. So I just wondered if you could talk about the first one, which is the publishing house, which is Andalus Publishing House. It's quite an interesting story.
Yeah, thank you. So, I mean, chapter 4 of the book, The Palestinian Al-Andalus, is mostly about documenting the various uses and understandings of Al-Andalus in Palestinian culture. But at the end of the chapter, in a kind of coda, I try to turn to something else, which is the diverse meanings and uses of Al-Andalus in Israeli culture. Because just as it's proven productive for Palestinian authors and artists, Al-Andalus has also inspired a number of different Israeli actors and artists. To take up the case of Andalus Publishing, that is a publishing house that was founded in 1999 and was really the first major project for translating Arabic literature into Hebrew. It's a project that was active mostly from 1999 until about 2010. That was officially open a little bit after that. And I should say that the first book they ever translated into Hebrew was actually a book by Mahmoud Darwish. This is really interesting because I think here you see an Israeli activist and artist, her name was Yael Aler, who turn to the memory of Al-Andalus, in this case, as a sort of metaphor or model for what Jewish-Arab coexistence might look like. I don't know if we have time, but I think I might just read very briefly from the publisher's Declaration of Intentions when the publisher was founded in 1999. The publisher said, and I'm quoting, "Andalus is a new publishing house that specializes in the translation of Arabic literature and prose into Hebrew. Andalus, the site of the golden age of Islamic and Jewish thought, was also an era during which Jewish and Arabic cultures fed and fertilized one another, an epoch known for its literary and intellectual output by some of the greatest Muslim and Jewish philosophers, theologians, and poets. It was a period during which materials were translated from Arabic to Hebrew and vice versa." So what I find fascinating about this example is you see this publisher, Yaler and Andalus Publishing, working at a moment in the early 21st century, the turn of the 21st century, in which the peace process, the Oslo Accords, have kind of collapsed, in which the separation between Israeli Jews and Palestinian Arabs, between the Hebrew language and Arabic language, the separation seems stronger than ever. It seems almost irreconcilable. Mm. She turns to the memory of Al-Andalus as a sort of model for imagining a much longer history of rich Jewish, Muslim, and Jewish-Arab interaction. Mm. And so I would say that that's one of the ways in which Al-Andalus has served in Israeli culture. It served as a model of Jewish-Arab or Jewish-Muslim coexistence, trying to root projects of collaboration and coexistence in the present in the much longer model of Al-Andalus in the past. But that's not the only thing that Al-Andalus has done in contemporary Israeli society. And I think you also wanted to ask me about another part of the
story. I'm gonna be dreadful with this pronunciation, the Mizrahi Jews, which, I mean, when I was reading the book, you know, in times of on social media, you know, where there's no depth to a lot of things, and with the current climate in Gaza, you forget that you know that there are different sections of both the Palestinian society and the Israeli society. I found this group particularly fascinating. Could you explain it, who they are?
Mizrahi, which really just means Eastern, in Hebrew, is a catch-all term that's used to describe the Jews who immigrated from North African and Middle Eastern countries to Israel, largely in the 1950s and 1960s. Uh-huh. And so I'm thinking about the Jews of Morocco, the Jews of Iraq, among many other places. So we can think of the Mizrahim, that's the plural, Mizrahi Jews, as one of the major groups of Israeli society. But it's a group that's really been at the margins, economically, socially, culturally, in large part because Israeli society and politics, and I'm generalizing here, but I think it's a generalization I can stand by, has largely been centered on Ashkenazi identity. So the Ashkenazi identity are Jews who descend from Eastern Europe, from the largely Yiddish-speaking lands of Eastern Europe. And many of the early leaders of the Israeli state and the kind of political and cultural elites of the Israeli state were Ashkenazi Jews. And so you have this other group of Jewish Israeli citizens who arrive en masse in the 1950s and 1960s, whose primary language is not Hebrew, it's not Yiddish, it's in fact Arabic.
Right.
Who are not claiming descent from Eastern Europe, but actually are coming from Morocco and Baghdad, places all around the Middle East and North Africa. And they really find a difficult time situating themselves in Israeli culture that was centered around a different idea of Jewishness and a kind of Ashkenazi model of Jewishness. Where does Al-Andalus come into the story here? Well, in recent years, Al-Andalus has become a sort of tool for celebrating and mobilizing around Mizrahi identity in Israeli culture. A number of different Israeli cultural producers, artists, have turned to Al-Andalus as a sort of a model of cultural prestige that is a way of saying Mizrahi Jewishness, so being an Arab Jew or an Arabic-speaking Jew, was not always a position of social, economic, or cultural marginalization. In fact, at some moment in the past, Arabic-speaking Jews were among the most culturally sophisticated and important figures of the Jewish world. And so you see projects like a really significant example would be the Israeli Andalusian Orchestra, which is an orchestra of musicians. It's actually a very diverse group. You have Arabs, you have some Palestinians, you have Mizrahi Jews, you have a lot of Russian immigrants who play. So in terms of the members of the group, it's quite diverse, but their repertoire is largely music that they associate with the musical legacy of Al-Andalus, either music that they claim originates in medieval Al-Andalus or music that was inspired by that legacy and emerged in other parts of the Arab world, in North Africa in particular. And so this is a group, the Israeli Andalusian Orchestra, that's very, very popular. It's won some really significant awards and recognitions in Israel. And really what they do is they use Al-Andalus as a way of rooting Mizrahi identity. So this contemporary identity category, Mizrahi, which is unique to Israel, in a much deeper history of prestige that is not rooted through the Ashkenazi experience, is not rooted through a kind of European hegemony or European dominance, but instead is rooted through the Arab and Arabic culture of Al-Andalus and the ways in which that legacy continues to live on among Mizrahim in Israel today. So that would be another way in which Al-Andalus and its memory is fitting into identity politics in contemporary Israel.
I mean, talking about music, I mean, that is one of the ending of the book is you concentrate on music, but it's not just people singing about Al-Andalus. It's kind of bringing a lot of the strands that you've been playing with in the book together. I mean, could you give us a bit of a rundown on how Al-Andalus has influenced music in, I'm sure, many places?
Sure. Yeah. So first of all, I should say I've made a Spotify playlist for the book.
Oh, wow. Cool.
With songs that I talk about in the book or that inspired me while I was working on the book. So maybe we can put that in the episode, in the episode notes.
Definitely.
I really wanted music to be front and center in this book because music is actually the door, the kind of point of entry I had to Al-Andalus. I didn't come through Al-Andalus through reading or through poetry, but actually through sound and dance. When I graduated from high school, I actually took time off from school and I moved to Spain to study flamenco at a flamenco academy in Seville. This was my first time ever in Spain, my first encounter with Southern Spain, my first time in a place where the architectural legacy of Al-Andalus is so clear. I visited the Alhambra, the Mezquita de Córdoba, but I also was there to study this specific musical form, flamenco. And I had this thing where a lot of my teachers were telling me, oh, this music, the reason that it sounds so distinctive is because it comes from the legacy of Al-Andalus. Very often they would use the term los moros, it would come from the Moors, but I'm going to kind of avoid that term and say what they were saying is that in some way that this is a musical or performance tradition that makes us unique because of our connection to this legacy. Uh-huh. And at the time when I heard this, I really had no critical tools to assess that claim. You know, why do you think that? Well, what does it mean when you say this music comes from Al-Andalus? And I think about this part of the book as returning to my 18-year-old self with a different set of critical tools and trying to imagine, like, what does it mean when someone claims to make music that comes from Al-Andalus? And how do those claims vary in different contexts? Because it turns out that there are musicians all around the world who claim to be making music in the legacy of Al-Andalus or in the wake of Al-Andalus. And yet those musical projects sound really, really different from each other. So I'd say like one lesson that comes from that chapter is that like one way to hear Al-Andalus is to understand that others might hear it differently. Mm. There's this kind of process of differential listening that I think Al-Andalus teaches us. Many of the different musical traditions I discuss in that chapter are ones that might be familiar to your listeners, and they might even think of them as being connected to Al-Andalus in some indirect way. So flamenco would be a major example. There's a lot of discussion of flamenco and debates about its origins in that chapter. Various North African musics, including the North African music that's commonly known as Andalusi music, is in that chapter. And so I talk about a number of practitioners who perform in this tradition that you can see it in the name, claims descent from Al-Andalus. And critically, I discuss the long history more recent history of over the past few decades of European, largely Spanish, and North African, largely Moroccan musicians coming together to do these musical collaborations that claim to recover both the sounds and the spirit of Al-Andalus, by creating sounds that cut across different cultural and religious and linguistic lines. Mm-hmm. Now, that's one part of the chapter, imagining playing music that can claim some kind of genealogical link to Al-Andalus.
Yeah, yeah.
But the chapter ends in a very different place, in a place that I'm hoping will surprise readers, because Al-Andalus always surprises me. Where people go with Al-Andalus always surprises me, so I actually wanted to end the book on something that people wouldn't expect. And that's with the hip-hop Al-Andalus. Now, you wouldn't immediately associate medieval Iberia with hip-hop. One can hardly claim. I don't know of any rappers who claim, oh yes, rap, it comes from medieval Iberia. And yet, if you look around the world of hip-hop, there's this vast universe of allusions to Al-Andalus. And they really come from all over the world. In U.S. hip-hop, I'm thinking like someone like Sa Rock in her song, Moors of the Alhambra, all over French hip-hop, but particularly in Spanish and Moroccan hip-hop. You see this kind of density of allusions to Al-Andalus. And using Al-Andalus to debate various kinds of identity problems and identity politics in Spain and Morocco today. So I call this project Straight Flow, because I think of it as a kind of lyrical practice, kind of a hip-hop practice that draws its energy and its inspiration from the long history of people and ideas and sounds moving across the Strait of Gibraltar. So I call it Straight Flow. And so in that last part of the chapter, I'm looking at various examples of straight flow, the ways in which people have spoken to and about Al-Andalus from hip hop, and the ways in which Al-Andalus, in particular in hip hop, has been used to promote a kind of alliance politics that connects different kinds of marginalized communities. So some of the most obvious might be Muslim or Arab immigrants in Spain. That's one that comes up. But it's not limited to that. I mean, usually artists who are doing that are often using Al-Andalus to establish links to other kinds of marginalized groups, be it the kind of economically marginalized groups, connections across the Atlantic to the urban poor in the United States and to Black American artists. Al-Andalus has proven this really fertile ground for imagining a kind of resistant minoritarian identity in Spanish hip hop and also in Moroccan hip hop. And so the chapter ends there with rapping about Al-Andalus and what the politics of that are. And if anyone wants to hear what that sounds like, the two places I would recommend starting would be, one, the Spanish rapper of Moroccan origin, Khaled, Khaled. And I discuss several of his songs. He's someone who does these really interesting songs with code switching between Spanish and Arabic, and I talk about several of his songs in the chapter. And another really interesting artist I'm interested in is the Moroccan rapper named Moro. He actually goes by the Spanish word Moro or Moor, even though he himself raps predominantly in Arabic. And he's another one of these people who alludes to the memory of Al-Andalus, but in a way that's really less about the debating the past and more about calling out social injustices in the present. Mm. So that's where the book lands.
Mm. And I mean, I don't want you to divulge too much of your book, but the last chapter was really actually quite personal to me, because I got married outside the mosque of Cordoba. So, you know, I was married in a hotel opposite the main gate of the mosque in Cordoba. So I really enjoyed that. But it's one thing that I really noted about the book was how Spain is present all the time, but as you said, Al-Andalus is kind of broken free of the borders of Al-Andalus. So I just wondered what your opinion was on how Spain as a country, and I'm not sure how much experience you've had with this, deals with the legacy of Al-Andalus. Because it's kind of a very, you know, it's very specific when it comes, when we put it into the European context, you know, it's not something that Britain or Germany deal with. It's kind of like this very other, this very Muslim heritage.
Yeah. Great question. Hard question. There's a reason that I left Spain to the very end of the book.
Uh-huh.
And the reason is actually because I kind of wanted to decenter Spain in conversations about Al-Andalus.
Uh-huh.
I'm not the only person who's interested in the ways in which Al-Andalus is used today to debate identity politics, but a lot of the work on this topic, I think, has been really focused on Spain and Spanish national identity,
right,
often to the exclusion of things that are happening in other countries, and particularly in Arab and Muslim majority contexts. And so I really wanted to make an effort to center Arab and Muslim voices in this chapter in contemporary conversations about Al-Andalus, in this book. But of course, Spain had to be part of the book as the geographic site of Al-Andalus and as a place where debates about the legacies of Al-Andalus continue today. I couldn't just avoid Spain. My way of doing it was decentering it by putting it to the end. So rather having it be the point of entry, I have very other points of entry. But of course, like, Al-Andalus continues to be one of the flashpoints for debating what it means, what Spain is as place, as concept, what Spanish is as cultural category. And I think really, I try to get at that question in the epilogue through the ongoing debates about the names and meanings and uses of the mosque or mosque cathedral or cathedral of Cordoba. And as you can already tell, whether you call it a mosque cathedral or a cathedral, says something about how you tie it to a larger historical narrative of belonging.
Mm.
Really, I think in Spain, as in the U.S., because there are a lot of debates about Al-Andalus in the U.S. as well, I mean, Al-Andalus becomes a sort of proxy for larger debates about how Islam and Muslims fit into the fabric of Spanish national identity.
Uh-huh.
Are they somehow external to it? Is Spanish identity built in opposition to Muslim identity? That might be a kind of more of a right-wing understanding, mm-hmm. imagining Spain as a kind of national country that was forged in some sort of long historical battle against Muslims.
Yeah, like the reconquest. The reconquest is the big one, right?
Yeah, of course. And you see, I mean, that's still live today when you see people like Abascal and the Vox Party mm-hmm. alluding to that heritage very openly, you know, claiming proudly to be kind of descending from that history of Reconquista. I'm going to put that word in air quotes. But then, of course, there are other ideas, you know, there are other actors who might want to use Al-Andalus to promote a much more open, fluid, multicultural idea of what it means to be Spanish. And I think that those openings to Al-Andalus allow us to think of phenomena that we might think of as recent, like North African immigration to Spain, to be actually something that's part of a much longer history that's sort of baked into the fabric of Iberian history, and I would say Spanish history. And so Al-Andalus, in that case, becomes a way of debating, have Muslims and Islam always been part and parcel of what it means to be Spanish or not? I obviously have my take on that as an enthusiast and lover of Al-Andalus. I would say decidedly yes. I think that Spain as it is today is unthinkable without the rich heritage of Al-Andalus. It is indeed one of the things that makes Spain distinctive from other kinds of some of its European neighbors. But like, since I'm not either a permanent resident of Spain or a Spanish citizen, I don't really get to decide. What I'm trying to do in that epilogue is sort of do a sort of radiography or show how this one site, the Mosque of Cordoba, can be used as a sort of lens through which to show all of the different competing narratives that go into talking about Al-Andalus in contemporary Spain today.
Yeah, and I mean, there really are it's very political battles over how the mosque is used. I mean, it's very the bit that stood out most for me though was, you know, you're talking about the church using it in one way in one period of time, and then this kind of left-wing platform using it as another way, but actually the two kind of groups of Muslims aren't really that involved, or they're not really, they don't want to get in trouble, kind of thing.
No, that's absolutely true. So, I mean, hopefully if people have a chance to read that part of the book, they'll be able to read a little bit more about what's happening in Cordoba kind of roughly since 2006, in which there's been this eruption of debates about who owns that site, what should the site be called, is it a mosque, is it a mosque cathedral? And the really interesting thing is that although the argument is fundamentally, are we are Muslims part of the collective us or not? The people who are participating in that debate are largely not the Muslim community of Cordoba. This is largely different, we could say, like, Christians or maybe people of Christian descent, even if they're non-practicing, using Al Andalus and using this Muslim heritage site as a proxy for a larger identity debate. And surprisingly, some of the people who have been absent, or maybe not surprisingly, because maybe they have more pressing issues to deal with, are the Muslim, the members of the Muslim community of Cordoba. And so I did try to do some interviews with kind of some of the Muslim community leaders in Cordoba there to kind of share some of their perspectives on that debate as well. But I do see that the debate in Cordoba is largely not about, it's largely not being driven by Spanish Muslims. It's largely driven by non-Muslim Spaniards who are using Spain's Muslim heritage as a way of debating what they understand Spanishness to be.
Wow.
And yeah, and so hopefully people have a chance to read that part of the book. It was one of the most fun to write. I tried to make it a little bit narrative as a fun way to end the book. And I also tried to connect it to my own experiences because, as you might remember from the beginning of the epilogue, the mosque in my hometown in Illinois, in the town I live in Illinois, is actually modeled after the Mosque of Cordoba. Like, its facade is its design is an homage to the Mosque of Cordoba. Mm-hmm. So I try to use Cordoba and the Mosque of Cordoba as a sort of larger architectural metaphor for thinking about how ideas about Al-Andalus travel far and wide, not only within Spain, but much, you know, for far beyond Spain, including here in central Illinois, which many of your listeners will not at all associate with Al-Andalus, but I would argue is part of that rich and diverse fabric of Al-Andalus.
Yeah. And I mean, the mosque is a beautiful place, right? I mean, if you ever get the chance to go to Cordoba, it's such a mixture of, because it has a Catholic cathedral in the middle, such a weird combination. Unbelievable.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'd say, if nothing else after this interview, I hope people will go and read Darwish and then go visit the Mosque of Cordoba, one of my favorite authors and one of my favorite places in the world. They've both given me a lot to think about.
Thanks very much for your time, Eric.
Thank you so much. This was an absolute delight. And thank you for reading the book.